I would love to start. My name is Delila Butler, and I'm a program coordinator with Prevention Institute. And I'd actually love to start by getting a feel for who all's in the room this early Wednesday morning, last day of the conference. How many folks here are part of public health departments? Okay, seems like half the room. What about community-based organizations? All right, kind of. We got a semi, a so-so back there, so like community-based. What about education, schools, universities? Great. And then how about healthcare organizations? I think pretty much everybody. All right. Have I missed anything? Did anybody not raise their hand because I left something out? But so it's a good mix of people here today, which is wonderful. The reason I ask is because the tool for health and resilience in vulnerable environments that I'll be talking about today has actually been used by all of those different types of organizations, and so it'll be great to hear any feedback that you all have or answer any questions that you might have around the tool itself. You know, I wanted to start by giving a little bit of background on Prevention Institute, and oftentimes when I describe the work that we do, I think back to a conversation that I had with my grandpa. So way back in the day in my first career path, I was a chemical engineer, and my grandpa would say, oh, you know, my grandbaby is a chemical engineer. She's a chemical engineer. And then I got my master's in public health. I'm like, Grandpa, I got a master's. You know, this is awesome. And every single time, and he was still sharp as a tack, but every time I'd see him, he'd say, what do you do again? What is it that you do again? I'm like, Grandpa, public health. So I had to get really tangible. So we had a conversation one day where I said, all right, Grandpa, this is what I do. I work with different organizations as we think about, you know, their communities and how to create neighborhoods where people can walk safely, bike safely, they have access to healthy food. If you need to use your wheelchair or push a stroller, you're able to do so without any, easily. And it's really, you know, it creates a community where people can stay connected and they, you know, they have access to those things that will keep them healthy. And he's like, whoa, that's really great. I'm really proud of you. And from then on, I mean, of course, he picked out the one thing that really mattered to him. He would always say, so how's that work going that you're doing to help people with their wheelchairs to get around their community? But still, he kind of got it, right? He didn't ask me anymore, what is it that you do again? So Prevention Institute really creates tools and different types of research in order to help support organizations in different communities as they think about how to create places that really help to support health. And in addition to that, in some of our other work, we really try to help support and advocate for different changes in policies that would help support this work moving forward. We work in a number of different focus areas, from preventing violence and reducing unintentional injury. We actually have a couple of colleagues who are in Montreal right now talking at the Canadian Injury Prevention Conference. So we do this work not just in the United States, but we talk to people internationally about some of our work. We do a lot of work around reforming our healthcare system, so especially with the Affordable Care Act and really promoting its importance and really advocating for why that's an important change to our healthcare system. We do a lot of work around that. Supporting healthy food and activity environments, as I said, you know, really thinking about what are those tools and resources that people can use as they're thinking about what partners that they need to engage or which different approaches they might do that could be comprehensive to help support health in their communities. And we also do some focus a little bit on mental health and well-being. We do this across, we try to really focus on doing this across all communities, especially those communities that are really impacted by inequities. And, you know, there's many reasons for this. So one of them is that in our own backyard, we see quite a few inequities there in Oakland, California. Oakland's located in Alameda County, so just across the bay from San Francisco. And our public health department there, and there's a team called Place Matters that was also doing some work. So if you're familiar with Dr. Anthony Eiten, he did a lot of work, Dr. Tony Eiten, looking at the different life expectancies across Alameda County. And what they found is that in some areas of Alameda County, we're seeing really, really decreased life expectancies compared to other areas. And in fact, to get a little bit more tangible, what the study found is an African American child living in Oakland's flatlands will die on average 15 years before a white child living in the city's most affluent area, which is the Oakland Hills. And so, you know, we know as Prevention Institute that Oakland is not the only place where your zip code matters more than your genetic code, right? And so we were, you know, really wanted to do the work that would focus on how do we shift those environments then? How do we change those neighborhoods and support those communities so that they can also help folks have the opportunity to live their health to the optimal you know, live their healthiest life. We talk about the environment at Prevention Institute, not just about like exposures, like what's in your air, soil and water and how that impacts your health. But we also talk about it as what's in the environment or what options are available or not available that impact your behaviors that therefore impact your health. So one example of this might be if looking at alcohol availability in different neighborhoods. And so we've seen studies demonstrate that when you have increased availability of alcohol outlets, you also see increased consumption of alcohol, which we know is connected to health issues such as violence or cancer. And so, you know, we're thinking back, how do we connect that, you know, the availability of alcohol or the, you know, the overabundance of alcohol in certain neighborhoods to those things like violence and poor health issues. You know, I'm going to show a couple of images just to get us, you know, really thinking about, you know, what options are available to us in our neighborhoods. And I want you to know that none of these images are doctored. And so when you see this image, can somebody just tell me what health outcome do you think of when you see this image? Obesity and diabetes, right? This seems a little bit like an oxymoron. To tell you a quick story behind this, the manager of the store wanted to raise money for a juvenile diabetes foundation, and they felt that by offering, you know, 5 Junior Frosties for $1, that was a great way to raise funds. But as you can see, there's definitely a little bit of an oxymoron there, since we know sugar and overconsumption of fat is tied to type 2 diabetes. So when we think about, you know, what's in the places where we live, work, learn, and play, what options are available to us in our communities and how those impact our health, we recognize that there are really, you know, tangible opportunities to act and to address those communities' barriers so that we can really positively impact health. You know, when we think about not only what options are available to us, but are not, as you can see, you know, this person probably would love a median, some sidewalks, maybe a little road diet in order to be able to walk safely in this community. And, you know, thinking about the overabundance of things, this is a school cafeteria, right? So if you're thinking about what's in our environment and how it impacts our health, we can see some negative health outcomes there. And in addition to this, I don't know if you can see, but that's a school just across the street. So if you're thinking about young students walking to school and what they see, not only is their tobacco just being sold right on the corner, but heavily marketed. And so, you know, we look at these images all to really, you know, as a way to really enforce what I mentioned earlier, is how the environment really impacts our health. And the Institute of Medicine actually said it best when they said, it's unreasonable to expect people to change their behavior easily when so many forces in the social, cultural, and physical environment conspire against such change. And so, you know, the work at Prevention Institute, what we want to do is we want to think about, well, how do we then change those environments in order to help support health? And we do this through what's called quality, what we call quality prevention is the prescription, right? It's aimed at the environment, it's comprehensive, it involves a number of different partners, and it helps, you know, after time to change norms and really shift behaviors in order to support health. And we want to think about doing this, you know, across all communities, again, with the idea of health equity really being solidified throughout all of our work. You know, how do we especially do this in lifting up communities and leadership and capacity in communities that are experiencing the poorest health outcomes? And the reason we focus on quality prevention is because we know prevention works, right? So if we think about things like safety belts or, you know, thinking about smoking prevention, we have seen that really focusing comprehensively on addressing these efforts are addressing health issues before they begin is really important. So how do we create kind of the policies and changes in our environment in ways that help to support health? I want to give a couple examples, one being the bans on school junk food in California. So California recently... Okay. California recently passed a law, a statewide law, banning junk food in non-meal competitive, you know, school foods. And what they found is that California students actually ate less fat, sugar, and calories than other students in other high schools across the nation. So they're seeing some benefits to that, to those laws that they pass. Smoking prevention, you would never see, again, this is not a doctored photo, you would never see, a vending machine or very, very rarely see vending machines now available to buy cigarettes. This is more of an image of what you would see in our communities these days. And we're seeing that while we still have a ways to go with smoking prevention, I actually was recently writing some comments to the FDA around banning menthol and tobacco products. We know we have come quite a long way, right? So we have a ways to go, but we've come a long way. And really, we did this again through this idea of really taking two steps to the environment in order to think about how do we shape those environments in ways that support health. I want to use an example really quickly. If we think about diabetes, and we start with that health outcome. Oftentimes people say, oh, I really hope, you know, that person that has diabetes is getting the proper care, that they, if they have diabetes, they're being tested for it and it's being figured, you know, folks are understanding what their health condition is and how they manage it. And while healthcare is really important, access to culturally appropriate healthcare is important, it's also, you know, treats one person at a time. It oftentimes can't restore health to its optimum, the optimum place again. And so we really want to think about how do we move upstream? How do we prevent those illnesses or injuries from happening in the first place? So we go and we look at, you know, what are the behaviors that are associated with diabetes? And name a couple that you all know of. Type 2 diabetes, what are the behaviors that are associated with that?
Sedentary behavior.
Sedentary behavior. Right? Poor diet. So, you know, if you think about diet and activity patterns and tobacco as well as use of alcohol and drugs, those are actually three behaviors that we know are tied to the top five leading causes of death. And so let's focus in on, you know, the sedentary behavior that you mentioned before, right? Why is it that we see so many folks that are not being as active anymore? So we want to take a step to the environment to understand what is it that's keeping people from being active in the first place. And I wanted to provide an example. Daisy Romero is a 13-year-old in Santa Ana, California, who was asked, you know, why is it that you're not as active as you would like to be in your community? And she was given, you know, a camera to go and take pictures of her community and be able to say, here are, you know, what I feel are either barriers or opportunities for me to be healthy in my community. And what Daisy said when she took this picture was, we could use this as a place to play sports. We don't get to interact as much because we don't have places to play. The bond is broken. We could build a park so that kids my age can stay active, healthy, and connected. So at age 13, we were like, Daisy, can we hire you? Because she obviously really gets the importance of, you know, what's in her community, what's in her neighborhood, and how that really impacts her health and, you know, whether or not she can be active. And actually, you know, when we think about parks and open space in communities in general, we also know that there's a difference between what parks and open space are available across different communities. So the Trust for the Public Land did a study in LA looking at predominantly white neighborhoods, predominantly black neighborhoods, and predominantly Latino neighborhoods. And what they did was that they looked at how many acres of park space was available per 1,000 people. How many people... What do folks think of those three neighborhoods, that first 31.8 acres of park space per 1,000 people? Was it predominantly white, black, or Latino? Does anyone think it wasn't predominantly white? So, I mean, really, you know, when we think about what's in our environment and the norms around them, we know even in this room, there's a specific norm that we can identify even in this room of the differences that are available and options for people to be active across different communities. And, you know, we had identified parks and open space actually as one of 12 different elements of community health. And this was all part of the tool for health and resilience and vulnerable environments. We found it through a great deal of research and talking with a number of experts about what are those factors in our environments that really are tied directly to health. And as you can see here, we have quite a few of them, but they're easily, you know, they're really stated in ways that kind of resonate across a number of different perspectives and resonate with different folks. We try to really use plain language as we describe what those factors might be. I wanted to quickly give just a couple examples, and I realize we're out of time. I thought we had 20 minutes today. But what I can do is I'm happy to provide additional information on the actual factors themselves. I did want to say that the Thrive tool is a really important tool. It's in itself, but it's really the process that people find has been most helpful. And that's because really what they do when using this tool is think about who are the important community and partners to engage and how to create a shared understanding across all of those partners. And again, because of the readability of the Thrive tool and its simplicity, it's really been helpful for engaging a broad number of constituents and helping people talk about these elements that are directly related to health in ways that are easy to understand and to discuss. We had a couple of pilot events where we did some work, and they really found that, again, one of the main things that stood out was the Thrive process as an opportunity to really discuss and talk through what those social determinants are in ways that were really easy and engaging across a broad set of partners in a multidisciplinary setting. If you have any further questions, please let me know. Also, I just want to make one announcement. Lily Schwartz is also with our organization, and she's doing interviews for folks who want to talk a little bit about public health and community prevention. So if you're interested in being interviewed and speaking a little bit to that, please see Lily after the session. Thank you.